The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Moore Cheeks is the author of Acts of Forgiveness, a debut novel that imagines a contemporary moment in which our government has approved reparations for Black Americans, but only if they can prove they are descendants of enslaved people. The book is based on a feature-length article she produced during a masthead reporting residency at The Atlantic. Best-selling author R. Eric Thomas calls the book a generous and empathetic study. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Zoe Sivak, author of Mademoiselle Revolution. Please welcome Maura Cheeks and Zoe Sivak to the Free Library.
You deserve it. This is different.
Well, I know we just clapped. I know we just did it, but I always like to welcome everyone just to get out the joy and the happiness and the celebration when someone writes and publishes their first novel. Yeah.
Get it out.
Okay. So again, my name is Zoe. This is Maura. And we're here to just have a semi-casual, we are wearing blazers, don't let that intimidate you, semi-casual conversation about this absolutely incredible novel. I'm going to just ask a few questions. Some are going to be spontaneous because I'm sure she's going to have really riveting answers that are going to make my brain play ping pong. And then you folks are going to ask us some questions. And we'll just take it from there. You ready?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I think my first question that I would ask any author is, how did the idea behind Acts of Forgiveness form?
Okay. Let's see. I've answered this a lot over the past couple of days, but I was writing an article for The Atlantic, right. And I wrote that in 2019. And in that, I was sort of exploring the racial wealth gap and sort of like why these systemic inequities have persisted for decades and decades. And so I continued to have a lot of questions about like our inability to solve these problems. And so fiction started to feel like the best way to explore some of those questions, in a way that like you can't really do in journalism because of the fact checking.
Hate that.
So yeah. So I don't know. I wanted to imagine a book where we're sort of at a point where we're not like debating if we should pursue these policies, and instead start the book at a place where we've already decided to pursue the policy. In this case, reparations, and then just imagine what that would be like for one family.
Thank you. And I think that's absolutely incredible that you found this novel in the space between fiction and nonfiction. I write historical fiction, so I can very much identify with that. And I think that that's beautiful that you were able to realize this out of something that you were, you know, initially sharing in one form, and it was able to breathe new life into another. I just think that's absolutely lovely.
Thank you.
So then I guess that kind of moves into the second question, which, you know, I don't know how familiar, you know, you guys might all be secretly publishers. Like, I have no idea. Hi. So nice to see you all. But so just for folks that maybe aren't as familiar or, you know, and everyone's journey is unique, what did this timeline look like for Acts of Forgiveness from conception of that idea, which I know was your article, to this beautiful creature right here?
It felt like a million years. So I had the idea in 2019, and then obviously in 2020, a lot changed in the world. So I remember when my first agent and I were discussing the book, it was pitched as like highly speculative. Obviously, you know, George Floyd was murdered, and like the idea of reparations came into the conversation in a way that it hadn't when I first started writing the book. And then I ended up switching agents, and so then it was pitched as speculative, but only slightly. And so I don't know. It was a long journey. I think if you go with a larger publishing house, the journey is kind of longer sometimes, just because of the bureaucracy. I sold it in 2021, and here we are.
Here we are, and we're so glad that we are here. I love it. So then. Actually, you kind of touched on it, because, and maybe this might be a slightly more authory question, but you know, when I finish the novel and I kind of lean back and I think, you know, how do you? There's the marketing way that you might market a book, right? How do you see this novel? Do you see it as spec? Would you call it, you know, sci-fi? Which I know might sound strange for, you know, folks out in the audience, but you know, if anything has a fantasy element or an alternate history. You know, would you call this historical fiction? How do you kind of label this book in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't pick a genre and like write towards that genre when I started. I would say it's like literary realism. I know that that's not a you can't pitch and sell a book as that.
But that's
it's
how
technically
you see it.
Not a genre. I don't know. I don't think of genres in that way when I'm writing necessarily. I kind of just write and then I let readers or my editor tell me what it is.
I like that. Just vibes, guys. It's about the vibes. I love that. That's fantastic. I write historical fiction. I will talk about things, you know, until I'm blue in the face. Reconstruction from a legal standpoint, from a social justice standpoint. I really invite all of you to explore it a little bit further, because it was a moment in time where this country could have looked very different, and then it changed. We had a certain president who plays a minor role in this story, and I want to give you the opportunity maybe to paint a picture for people as to why Reconstruction matters, and some of the, you know, even zooming forward to, you know, post-Japanese internment, you know, what are some of the big historical beats that readers might want to lightly familiarize themselves so that this novel hits how it should?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't gotten that one yet.
Oh my God, queen.
I think, for me, I wanted to, like, part of the book is the fact that I wanted to imagine what would have to be true for a federal reparations policy to pass. And so in the book, the president in the book is a descendant of Andrew Johnson. So for me, I think part of imagining the federal reparations policy is thinking about, for someone in power to pass it, they would have to be in some way like deeply connected to sort of like why the inequities exist and what didn't happen in Reconstruction, right? And so, I think that plays an important role in just how I was thinking about the framing of the book, like what would actually have to be true in the United States government at that time for a federal policy to pass. And I think there are a lot of people in power now who do advocate for reparations, but not enough to actually like put their neck on the line, right? Really? And so, I think, you know, the president in the book, in this case, feels sort of like a deep personal responsibility to make sure it passes.
Yes. And I really enjoy, again, this is because this book has just come out, you know, this will be spoiler free, but I find that the way that you utilize this president, you keep her at the forefront of the story in very unique ways,
and keeps us thematically on theme as we move through the story. And I think, you know, it's a masterclass in kind of keeping politics emotional, which is, again, a theme in the novel that, again, I encourage everyone to engage with, not only as they read, but in their actual lives. And you, again, touched on it a little bit. You're really just ahead of me. I'm loving it. You know, reparations is the entire basis of this novel.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been saying it throughout, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, but Black lives are not a monolith, right? Black people have varying experiences and various interpretations of their struggle, and thus have varying opinions on reparations. And I think it can be a painful conversation because you can't talk about reparations without talking about a lot of pain that we like to dissociate from. And so I would love it if you could explore, you know, acknowledging that, again, we don't speak for all Black people or all mixed people or all women or all writers, et cetera. You know, why are reparations such a touchy subject, not only in the world at large, but for Black Americans?
Yeah, I don't know. I could share my inbox with you with all the hate mail I've gotten. I don't know. I think it's a lot of it is like a strain of not wanting to look in the past and like wanting to look to the future. And so, if you're asking for reparations, there's the nature of it is looking back at what happened. And so, I think a lot of people don't think that that's a worthwhile exercise necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a part of it. There's so many, it's funny, it's like such a touch point for a lot of people in a lot of different ways in ways that other topics are not. Like it kind of unites people across different political spectrums because everyone has a strong reaction to it.
Right.
I mean, I think not wanting to look back at the past is one thing. I think another is not wanting to take handouts. And so, and then I think there's another strain of like, well, would every Black person get reparations? What about people who are wealthy? Like, would they get the same amount as someone who's not as wealthy? So I think it just brings up a lot of confusion too in terms of how that would actually work.
Yes.
That kind of answered your question.
It did. And I know it is an incredible ethical exercise to have this conversation, and I encourage people to speak with their peers about it. I'm always inviting people to get into really uncomfortable conversations with people that you see regularly. It's great. Something that I always find myself thinking of, you know, when we talk about reparations, this isn't a question, it's just all of my big feelings, is that I think it reminds me a lot, because again, you can't talk about reparations without talking about a lot of trauma and a lot of pain. Yeah. And I think that for many people in this audience, enslavement, we don't put a lot of emotion behind enslavement. I think the most emotion that we were kind of engaged with is that very familiar picture of that one Black man with his back completely keloid over with, you know, with being whipped. And that's the photo, right? You cringe, you're uncomfortable. And you're like, oh, and then you flip the page, and then it's like, oh, Andrew Jackson, and like, you know, we move on.
Yeah.
And I think somehow you miss a lot of the nuances that come with being property from a legal perspective, and I think you lose out a great deal on the generational pain that occurs and a lot of the abuse and assault that comes with being human, but legally not. Mm-hmm. And this novel does a beautiful job of handling that reality in a way that is appropriate and real, but not exploitative, which is hard when looking at Black pain, because there have been many forms of media that exploit it because it can be interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the Black community is great with our mental health, and to engage with reparations is to go down a really painful path that I don't think a lot of Black Americans invite into their families and into their home.
Yeah. I mean, I also, in the book, and so I interviewed pretty extensively a professor called, his name is William Darity. And so he wrote a book called From Here to Equality. And so he studied pretty he's done an in-depth study of like what reparations could actually look like if you were to implement it. And so I think what I touch on in the book too is that it's not just about righting the harms from slavery, right? It's also looking at like the Jim Crow South and sort of like how do you right these wrongs that persisted after slavery and redlining as well. So I also think that's an element of it too. It's just there's so much hold in your mind when it comes to a reparations policy and what that would be trying to solve for that I think it's almost easier to sort of just push it away.
Right. And so and this will be my final question on this specifically, but, you know, in speaking with Professor Derry, and, you know, considering, did you always know that it was going to be financial reparations? I, from an academic standpoint and from my perspective, an ethical standpoint, that makes the most sense. But I know that there are some individuals that, you know, would argue for other forms of reparation, with, you know, whether that be a formal apology or, you know, other things.
Yeah.
You know, had the amount always been kind of determined from the get-go? You know, how did you land on the format of reparations in this novel?
Partly from my conversations with him,
right.
Yeah, and partly from reading his book, and also just because I, like you, believe that that makes the most sense,
right.
And also for the plot of the novel.
100%.
But
yeah, plot is a big deal, people.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, a lot of books treat it, and media in general treat it, reparations as sort of a punchline. So I wanted to see if I could do something that was more realistic, right? And not treating it as satire necessarily, but like an actual policy that passes and like what that means for one family.
You take Black people seriously.
Like well, that's... Not to say, I mean like, I don't know, Dave Chappelle's like reparations I feel like is what a lot of people think of, which is funny and like has its own
appropriate
purpose,
area,
maybe.
Yes.
But... And there's other novels that, like, touch on reparations,
right.
The Sellout by Paul Beattie, which, like, they touch on it and deal with it in a way through satire, which is, like, totally
legitimate.
Fine, and,
yeah.
and it's a great book.
Yeah.
I wanted to try and do something different because I hadn't seen that done before.
Yeah, which is kind of disappointing. But if anyone's going to speak to it well, it's you, and so thank you. I'm sure many people in the audience, you know, if they haven't had a chance to read it already or reading it now, it is taken seriously, which sometimes we're not taken seriously. So thank you very much. Now, moving on to, I don't know if I would say fun, but Philly. So you choose, so Philly plays a dominant role in this novel, not a spoiler. And, you know, we talked a little bit, you know, out back, you know, about what that meant to you. But was Philly always going to play a role? Or did you kind of fall upon it, as so many people do in this city? So yeah, so how did we end up with Philly?
Complicated question. I mean, I knew that just given the structure of the book, it was going to be a city in the north. And I started, I mean, the genesis of the book, some of it came from not being able to trace my family further than the American South. And so I think that that was a natural, Philly felt like a natural place to start. And because the city does have such a strong, you know, Black history. And so, yeah, I mean, it made sense for me. It wasn't any other city that I started writing about. And then was like, no, let me choose Philly.
Beautiful. Something else that I found myself thinking about was the way that you handled kind of the identity politics of reparations, and then it turns into just identity in the novel and having to trace your roots, and you just kind of touched on that again. It's like, where, how far back can we really go? There's an excellent scene that kind of speaks to how difficult that can be, not only as an adult, but as a child. You know, how many school exercises, you know, like, trace your family tree, or where are you from? And that's stolen from millions of Americans. So, you know, when you were writing this, how personal did you get? You know, did writing this novel heal you? Did it kind of tap into, not to quote from your book, but kind of a rusty part of yourself that you kind of had maybe been left neglected? Or have you always felt very aligned with your blackness and in your family?
I've always been drawn to tracing my family tree. I think it's really hard to do, at least for my family. I think when I started, I wrote like several drafts where I hadn't gone that deep on the genealogy. Right. And then I realized that I wanted to and had to for the book. Yeah, I mean, I went to Mississippi to research that part of the book. And so some of Willie's journey is like mimicking, well, I met with the employees at the archives and sort of like explained the character and what she was trying to do. And so they sort of like walked me through what would her journey look like if she had certain pieces of information. Certain pieces of those information were similar to what I had on my end for my family. Mm-hmm. But then a lot of it I pulled from a book called Finding a Place Called Home, which is I believe the author has passed away, but her name is Dee Parmer Woodger. And she does a lot to like map out how, like which documents African-Americans can use to retrace their history, because a lot of it has been lost, right? So it's like marriage certificates and bills of sale and just like if you have certain pieces, how do you sort of follow that trail?
Right. Thank you. Yeah. And in reading that again, it's this novel. I always say that I think that really, really good books answer a question, right? Maybe a question that you didn't know that you had. But I had this question, what if reparations were real? Like I'm talking about the Tooth Fairy. and this book answers that question, but it also answers those questions about how do I go back, right? What documents do I look at? And I knew, you know, from author to author, when I was kind of reading through this, I was like, she did this, mm-hmm. right? I was like, what's a Soundex? You know, how would you, you know, B600? How do you follow it? What is this machine? What's the noise the machine makes? You know, and I could feel the research, the living history of what you had done. And I hope that it lays the bricks for the road for other individuals that look at this. And I mean, my first thought when I closed the book was I thought about my grandma Alma, you know, because she never left, right? My family never left. We were owned in Virginia and we stayed in Virginia. And now I'm here. You know, I had followed the Great Migration like many other individuals, just albeit, you know, just a few hundred years later. So yeah. I think that that's really beautiful, that you've really, this book opens a door, it's a key, and it's empowering. So again, thank you. And I keep saying thank you, but I mean it. No, I mean it. Like, it's really, it's a vulnerable thing when you're black and you're writing about black stuff. You know, it opens up a little part of you, and it's and sometimes it's hard. So I appreciate. I'm sure you had some sleepless nights and frustration.
A lot.
Right? Yeah. Headaches and annoyances and reading contemporary, you know, letters that were probably really, really painful. I've been in that boat, and it puts you in a really bad headspace.
Yeah.
So thank you for putting in that effort.
Stop thanking me, but
no, but like yeah, thank you. You got it. Okay, you're great. Oh my God. Okay. Okay, so now let's kind of zoom out even further. I think every book teaches us something, you know. What did this book teach you as an author about the craft? And I do call it the craft, right? Isn't that cool?
Patience, I think, would be the biggest one. Because I think when you're writing, there's an element of you that, like, wants to just get the draft down as quickly as possible. So that is probably the biggest thing that it taught me. Just from a writing perspective, but also from a publishing perspective of just like trusting the journey a little bit.
100%, no. Because we were on a fairly similar timeline, and your book just now came out, and mine came out a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So it's so variable. You can't really look at one author to another and say like it's copy and paste. It is truly very different for every individual. And then, you know, as far as the research goes, I mean, you described, you know, was there any specific moments that you remember that really resonated with you as you were trying to piece together this possibility, as well as looking back?
I mean, the employees at the archives were awesome. Like, I thought they were going to laugh in my face and be like, well, I don't know. You know, it's a fictional character. But they were amazing, and they like literally sat with me and like pulled out the documents, and they were like, okay, what's the last name? Like, well, it's not a real person, but they were great. And so that was a really cool experience of just like sitting with them and looking through documents. And some of the letters are real letters that we found. And
So
that was a cool experience.
That's incredible. And you give these people life by putting them here.
I think you really bring them to the present, which I think is absolutely incredible.
So then my final question is, what are you most proud of with this book?
Ooh, good question. I think the genealogy aspect, to be honest. Being able to bring in the genealogy, but then also I hope I did a good job of connecting it to a policy that feels as though it could actually be implemented today.
Well, I will do it one more time. Thank you.
Maura, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
My name is Queen Shapai Mamaw. That's my name. When you was talking, right, about reparation, I thought about, because I rap, so I thought about rapping a song about reparation. Want to hear it, the little part that I got?
Sure.
Okay. When I think about reparation, I think about they gave us 40 acres and a mule. When I think about the 40 acres and a mule, I think about the project and SEPTA, Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. That was as far as I got, but it was...
Thank you.
Well, thank you about that. But it went deep because I think we are all reparation, because we think about SEPTA, right? SEPTA ain't really a reparation because we paying for it. You get what I'm saying? We got to pay to get on the bus. So how is that a reparation? So I think we need to, I'm going to ask for some reparation, because I think we deserve that as a people. You know what I'm saying? And thank you. And I incidentally walked in here, and I'm glad I walked in here, and God is good. Thank you, God, in the name of Jesus.
Thank you.
She might not like me for this.
Oh,
you can say no to the first one, and then I have a second one. I'm wondering if you could read a little bit for us.
Sure.
Yes, thank you. And then my next question after is, how did you pick the name Revel?
Oh, good question. It's based on a senator named Hiram Rhodes Revels, and he was the first black senator.
Right before you read, when you said Revel, I really thought you were going to go somewhere French. Because I think of to dream.
Yeah.
And dreaming is, I'm sure you've, okay, never mind.
That was just great.
That's great. Okay. I thought I had the answer.
I'll read a little bit from chapter one.
Ooh, good choice.
Okay. The diner was full of people who wanted to be around others the day the Forgiveness Act passed the House. The proximity to precedent felt good. There was no danger, no history yet per se. No need to stop routine completely, so it was enough to sit in the old diner at the blue speckled tables with scrambled eggs and large steaming mugs of coffee. Enough to ask the person next to you to pass the ketchup and also whether they thought this would go anywhere. Not in my day was often the answer. Enough monotony rubbed off of a dreary fall day for neighbors to linger and comment that forgiveness would never pass the Senate, as the anchor announced the House's intention to vote on it in the evening. The country, the city, the diner, connected by the same wavering thread of expectation. As Willie hurried in, she took up her usual stool beneath the television and tried to look optimistic. But she had imagined when a moment like this one came, she would be sharing the news, not watching it. Writing about representatives wrangling last-minute votes, what families needed to do to prepare for its passage, not sitting as she was now, 34 years old, in the same town where she was raised. Most days she successfully calmed the disquiet, but today she couldn't help it and picked silently at her life choices like they were scabs. Vice president at her father's construction company. Mother to a precocious daughter from a one-night stand. Loving parents whom she lives with. The second half of those ellipses ruined the mirage. For a long time, she was buoyed by the belief that change was around the corner. And now that it was here, she realized she should have been more specific in her faith. The Forgiveness Act, for many reasons, threw this into sharp relief. I'll stop there.
Hello, ma'am. Thank you very much. Actually, writing a book is an act of leadership, especially your first one, so about very touchy subject. However, America, there is something very unique about American slavery. Slavery everywhere else was usually slave all over the world. They never breed, never make babies. You know what I mean? In Islam, for example, if you make babies, you become free. In the Bible, you spend 7 years and you can't be enslaved no more unless if you wanted to stay with. But however, in the American slavery, it's the American were breeding slaves, right? So yes. And also for every place where if you were born in Europe, if you were born in Russia, wherever, there is something that we call it the intelligence of the place. So here we have the American slave. They pursue their happiness. They are Americans. They think about their rights. The American free slave like they say, very unique segment of humanity. Do you think it is fair to write about that very real experience, and from the prospect of fictional history? In my opinion, when we fictionalize the slavery, right, the American slavery especially, we are diluting the crime.
Obviously I don't agree because I wrote about it, but I don't know. I mean, I think that fiction for a lot of people is a powerful way to share a message. Like, I don't think that a lot of people aren't reading, the WPA, Works Progress Administration, slave narratives to understand what it was like, right? So I think fiction for a lot of people is a way to access that history and share, communicate some of the emotion and feelings that people who were enslaved were experiencing.
And just another qualifier, learning to read and write was heavily regulated and oftentimes illegal. So many individuals that were enslaved were not able to share their story. And so it is absolutely critical to not only share real narratives, but I think to explore enslavement as a whole, whether fictional or non-fictional. I think the intent is to give a voice back to those whose voices were taken. Mm-hmm. So.
Hi. As I listen to you, I just happen to have seen the film Origin, which is based on the cast, mm-hmm. the book by
Isabel
Wilkerson. Yes, yes, yes. And I just started reading the book, but I just saw the movie as well. And I feel like what you're describing in terms of the book, because I have not seen it yet, but I will, very much dovetails with her premise, which is basically that it's caste, not race, that mm-hmm. is the heritage of this country, and that has resulted in the continuing oppression of enslaved people down through centuries. You know, Reconstruction was a moment, and then we went off the rails as we're doing again right now in a certain way. Do you see a parallel with that concept of caste?
And, yeah. Okay. I think it also touches on what you were saying, like the different reactions to reparations too, sometimes is class-based as well. The family that the book is based on is an upper middle class black family, which I think is also sort of goes against the traditional narrative when you think of reparations and how that story is normally told. So I chose to make it based on a sort of upper middle class black family on purpose to sort of like explore the concept of reparations within that framework, which is sort of what Isabel Wilkerson is talking about too, I think. I haven't seen the movie, but yeah.
It sounds wonderful. I'm going to race upstairs and buy it.
Thank you, Maura. Yeah. Just, I know it sounds like you did an incredible amount of research for your publication. Without saying how many hours, like, can you say a percentage? Like, do you research as a writer more than you write, or is it even? How would you split your time?
I'd say, that's 40% of time is spent researching. Yeah. I wrote a draft all the way through, and then I sort of make a list of the different areas I want to research deeper on. Mm-hmm. And then, I did that like 3 times. Yep. So, but yeah, I'd say like 40% is research, and the rest is spent writing.
Thank you.
For me. What about for you?
I was just going to say, I would say I spend more time researching than I spend, again, we write slightly different pieces, so it's, I had to... The other day, I had to look up the history of the pencil. I spend for my upcoming work. So I do find myself, and not every author is like that. I don't think there's a right or a wrong in how much realism you want it to be. The example I always use is that, you know, I'm not thinking critically about my pants, you know? And so I think sometimes we start to get a little too bogged down as readers, and you start to kind of romanticize the otherness mm-hmm. of these people, where I think the most important thing is to connect with them as people. So all of that said, yes, I do know about the history of the pencil.
Have you thought about your next book?
I have, but I'm not at liberty to discuss it.
This kind of follows the questions in this row, but I'm wondering about what your writing process looks like time of day, where you write, are you in coffee shops, at home, listening to music?
I write in the morning, so I try to write from like 5 to 7 or 5:30 to 7:30, and then usually I go back over what I wrote earlier in the day, I go back over it in the afternoon and either edit it or I like make a list of what I need to research, but I try and do the bulk of my writing in the morning, just because I feel like I'm less critical of myself in the morning, and I can sort of like write through whatever scene I'm on, and then I'll go back through.
No.
It's too early.
No, too early. I'm a night owl. I'm you know, it's 1 a.m. and I'm just like, this scene must be written. But I admire it. I admire it.
Hi, Maura. How are you?
Good.
Know that we're very proud of you as a family friend.
Thank you.
Glad to see you, and congratulations on the first book.
Thank you.
You spoke? You mentioned interviews, and I was curious as to how you used interviews and how did you weave them into your story, and might you share some of the people you interviewed that helped bring your book to closure?
So there's interviews throughout the book to sort of relay a lot of the information. So the main character gets a lot of information about what's happening with the Forgiveness Act through news reports and radio interviews. So there's a lot of like transcripts or pieces of news that she's hearing in the car or watching on TV. So I watched a lot of presidential speeches and listened to NPR interviews just to get like the cadence of how they're speaking. And yeah, I interviewed a lot of people. It's hard to, I don't know. I interviewed Professor Darity. I spoke about different authors who have written about reparations just to sort of understand the way that they approached it. But there's a lot of interviews that you'll read throughout the book.
Thank you all so much for your wonderful, wonderful questions. I know it fills our cups when you guys engage with us in this way. So thank you so much for coming out. But thank you again so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.